c'est la fièvre. Madame Docteur commence le dépeçage. Le capitaine la maître demande la réunion d'une nouvelle conférence. Car il s'agit de savoir si ce cirque va manger tout ou cul. On ne m'écoute jamais, dit le capitaine. Il insulte ses soldats, si quand même à réunir la conférence. Capitaine, chien, s'apporter les couteaux à ceux qui n'ont pas de fusil. Heimlotin, le chauffeur de camion, se propose d'amener le chien et le couteau. Hauka, regardez, je vais vous montrer un chien avant tout. Le méchant commande, donne des conseils au gouvernement. Alors le méchant commandant s'arrête à...
Pan, Cyclorama Tour. Polo and Pan. December 11th, Place Belle. One night only in Montreal. Get tickets now at evenco.ca. Polo and Pan, Cyclorama Tour.
Stand with Wet'suwet'en. McGill University must divest from TC Energy. A community campus action on Wednesday, December 1st, taking place just inside the Milton Gates at James Square. With poetry, speeches, and music, McGill University invests over $4.7 million into TC Energy Corporation, the company that is building the Coastal GasLink pipeline on Indigenous Wet'suwet'en lands. Now is the time for McGill University to divest from TC Energy. Join us for a campus community action at 5:30 on Wednesday, December 1st. This event is co-hosted by Divest McGill, the Indigenous Student Alliance, and is co-presented by CKUT Radio. See you there.
Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in the prison system and beyond.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
Before we get started with this week's theme, we wanted to share some prison-related news and announcements.
Six facilities that are part of New York's prison system will close next March amid a decade-long decline in the number of people the state incarcerates. The closures, announced Monday by State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision officials, scheduled for March 10, 2022, are Ogdensburg Correctional Facility, Mariah Shock Incarceration Correctional Facility, Willard Drug Treatment Campus, Southport Correctional Facility, Downstate Correctional Facility, and Rochester Correctional Facility. No layoffs are anticipated, and the cost cutting through the closures is expected to save $142 million. Spokesman Tom Malley said in his statement, quote, DOCCS will work closely with the various bargaining units to provide staff with opportunities for priority placement via voluntary transfers as well as priority employment at other facilities or other state agencies as a result of the formal civil service process that is followed with the closure of a correctional facility, end quote. State officials reviewed about 50 facilities for potential closure before selecting the 6 that will close next year. All of the facilities slated for closure have populations below 1,000 people, and some are operating at less than half capacity. The closures are the latest in a line of prison facilities to be shuttered by New York in the last 10 years, as the number of people in prison has steadily declined. New York's population of incarcerated people stands at 31,469, the lowest number since 1984. However, New York's prisons still hold roughly 2 times more incarcerated people today than in the 1970s. Advocates for criminal justice law reform called for further action from the governor, including the more frequent use of clemency and action on measures meant to make parole easier for older people in prison. Quote, "The governor must use her clemency powers frequently, inclusively, and transparently. She can and should end mass incarceration with the stroke of a pen," said Jose Saldana, the director of the Release Aging People and Prison Campaign. He continued, quote, "The legislator must pass the elder parole and fair and timely parole bills. Without these measures, and despite these closures, thousands will continue to needlessly languish behind bars," end quote.
The Board of Correction is meant to serve as an independent check on the entire New York City jail system and to ensure that those in city custody are treated humanely. It has the power to inspect the city's jails at any time, even daily, and issues reports which function as open letters on jail conditions or public notices that the Department of Correction has violated its rules. The board has a $3.3 million budget covering some 30 employees who are supposed to oversee a $1.2 billion jail system and its more than 9,000 Department of Correction workers. Yet the board has not issued any notices of violation during the COVID-19 pandemic, not even after board members had documented horrible conditions while investigating a death at the Rikers Island jail complex in April. During COVID, out of concern for both the health of staff members and detainees, the board cut back its visits significantly. Now, staff go into the jails, but they are not required to. When the board does make critical findings, it often has not shared them. A report on the first 3 deaths of Rikers detainees from COVID-19 was not released publicly until a public defender organization sought it using the state's Freedom of Information law. Even then, it was in draft form, and the board redacted the report's recommendations. As conditions worsened inside Rikers this summer, the board canceled its meeting in July and was unable to reschedule it for August because it could not summon enough of its members to meet the required quorum. "You're the oversight," Dr. Victoria A. Phillips, who works with the Urban Justice Center, testified at the board's meeting in September. "Oversee this work, make sure it happens. Please do it before someone else dies."
Staff shortages have long been a challenge for the correction system, given the low pay and grueling nature of the work. But the coronavirus pandemic and its impact on the labor market has pushed many prisons into crisis. Officers are retiring and quitting in droves, while officials struggle to recruit new employees. At a Georgia State House of Representatives hearing on prison conditions in September, a corrections officer testified that on a good day, there were maybe 6 or 7 officers to supervise roughly 1,200 people. He said he had recently been assigned to look after 400 prisoners by himself. There weren't enough nurses to provide medical care. Quote, "All the officers absolutely despise working there," said the officer, who didn't give his name for fear of retaliation. At federal prisons across the country, guards are picketing in front of their facilities over understaffing, while everyone from prison teachers to dentists is pulled in to cover security shifts. Unions representing prison officers also claim vaccine mandates will drive out unvaccinated employees and exacerbate understaffing, though it's unclear how big of an impact those rules will have. University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson writes, quote, "When jobs become riskier, it becomes harder to attract workers, By failing to protect prisoners from COVID, the criminal justice system not only created an unfair risk of severe illness and death for the incarcerated, but the increased COVID risk to employees has undoubtedly contributed to staffing shortages. Quote, "There are dozens of reasons to leave and very few to stay," said Brian Daw, national director of One Voice United, a nonprofit supporting corrections officers. Having fewer guards means significantly more dangerous conditions for incarcerated people. Growing shortages means a rise in lockdowns. Restrictions that might have begun as a way to stop the spread of COVID-19 have continued because there aren't enough guards to supervise activities. Some incarcerated people say they can't take classes, participate in group therapy sessions, or even work out in the recreation yard or take a shower. That can force those in general population into de facto solitary confinement, and those already in segregation into near total lockdown. 2/3 of the men in Nebraska's prisons can't see visitors on the weekends, when most families are free to travel, because of understaffing. Quote, "As of October, we have not had yard for 2 weeks," wrote one man at Illinois' Pontiac Correctional Center, where officials report 35% of correction officers' jobs are vacant. "I feel very overwhelmed. I can't talk about my problems to anyone. I pace back and forth and talk to myself because there's nothing else to do," end quote.
This week, we talked to our guest Bianca Tylek about prison phone industry giant Global Tellink. GTL profits off prisoners and their families by overcharging them exorbitant fees to talk on the phone. Recent grassroots activism from incarcerated people and other advocates have led to a wave of legislation mandating reduced costs or even free phone calls in some cities and states. Bianca Tylek is founder and executive director of Worth Rises, a nonprofit advocacy organization dedicated to dismantling the prison industry and ending the exploitation of those it touches. They work to return the economic resources extracted from affected communities and are part of the prison phone justice movement. This is the first of several episodes devoted to this topic. Here's Bianca.
My name is Bianca Tylek. I'm the founder and executive director of Worth Rises. We are a national criminal justice organization working to dismantle the prison industry and end the exploitation of those it targets. At Worth Rises, some of our most notable campaigns are in the prison phone justice space. We led the first successful campaign in the nation to make phone calls entirely free out of a jail system in New York City back in 2018. When that legislation went into effect, it saved directly impacted families nearly $10 million a year and increased communication by almost 40% overnight, which became the new normal. And there were so many more people who were incarcerated and detained who were able to communicate with their loved ones, communicate with their attorneys, communicate with social workers and other support systems they needed as they awaited trial and prepared for their cases. In the year that followed, we were able to help San Francisco get to a similar place. In 2019, San Francisco announced that it too would be going to free calls, and that went into effect in 2020, saved directly impacted families in the San Francisco area over $1 million every year, and again, increased communication by nearly 40% over overnight. Since then, we've been both leading and supporting campaigns around the country, both at the county level, but also now at the state level. We saw San Diego and Los Angeles go free, at least make the announcement in recent months, and working towards implementation. We're also working with Louisville, Kentucky, that will be looking to move in that direction. But we also passed our first statewide campaign in Connecticut this year in 2021, and Connecticut has now passed legislation making it the very first state to make all communication, that's not just calls, but also video communication, electronic messaging, all communication free across its entire prison system, which will go into effect in 2022. That is now a policy that is moving into other states for consideration, including Massachusetts, which just had two hearings on this legislation, and we're really hopeful that will pass by the end of the year. New York is also considering legislation for the 2022 legislative session, as well as Michigan and Virginia, which are getting ready to introduce. You know, there are the prison phone justice fight is really expanding and expanding rapidly at this point. And we're super excited to see it. So, I mean, somebody has to provide phone service, right? So who's doing it, right? The government's not providing it itself in most cases. In terms of how the corporations are responding, there are multiple corporations in this case, and it's important for people to understand that this is a $1.4 billion space that is dominated in large part by just three corporations, Securus, GTL, and IC Solutions. The last 10% is just a handful of very small niche companies. But these big three are really the dominant players, and all three of them are actually owned by private equity firms, or essentially investors and financiers. And those financiers have really been puppeteering in large part these companies for decades, and really reaping the benefits from this exorbitant extraction of wealth that these companies facilitate out of directly impacted communities. In terms of, you know, the direction in which we're all moving around free calls, obviously, this is not a trend that the corporations and the industry, you know, are a fan of. In fact, we saw in our Connecticut fight, Securus actually lobby against the legislation there. And it took us some time. I mean, eventually they withdrew their opposition, and that came from significant pressure from us and other advocates. But they had up until then been lobbying and spent $40,000 lobbying against our bill. You know, I think both Securus and GTL are not thrilled to see the movement towards free. Now, I want to note that just because calls are free for families and incarcerated people in jurisdictions that have passed this legislation does not necessarily mean that the communication itself is actually free. At some point, somebody provides communication services. And in most cases, that has meant that it's simply absorbed or paid like any other service in the prison, in a prison or jail. So take food services, for example, or healthcare. How is that paid? It's paid out of the regular operating budget of that agency, right, of that correctional agency. And so these pieces of legislation that make calls free for families and people who are inside essentially simply shift that cost back to where it should be, which is on the system that has chosen to incarcerate people. And so, you know, it's interesting because the corporations have, you know, less of, they're still going to get paid at the end of the day by somebody. But the reality is that they are going to get paid less. And the reason for that is because prior to this type of legislation, and in, you know, obviously the hundreds, if not thousands of places where phone calls are still being charged to families and incarcerated people, there is a profit sharing agreement essentially between the corporations and those correctional agencies, which means that it's not a competitive negotiation for the contract. They essentially give the contract to whoever will give them the most money. And so you see these models that are called commissions, but in real you know, words, it's just kickbacks, right? Kickbacks from the companies where they pay a certain percentage of the revenue that they make back to the correctional agency. Might be 30%, might be 50%, 70%. We've seen as high as over 90% of those rates being kicked back to the agency. Now, let's be clear. I mean, that is a huge part of the cost, but it's not the whole part of the cost. The corporations would love to scapegoat the correctional agencies and say it's, you know, it's these commissions that are driving up rates. But even in places that don't have commissions, the corporations are taking large chunks or where there might be commissions, what's left for the corporations is still pretty significant. But once you move to a free calling scenario where, in essence, the agency now has to pay for that service itself, not only is it not making the revenue that it was making previously, but now it has an incentive to actually negotiate a competitive contract because they don't want to be paying that much, right? When they were doing it on behalf of family and friends, they don't care because they were making part of that money. Now those rates are being driven lower and lower and lower because these agencies are saying, well, we don't want to pay those rates. And so that is what is obviously very frustrating to the corporations in this space. It is that shift, right, towards more competitive pricing negotiations around free calling models. That said, one of the other things to really look out for and understand in this field that's happening now is that they're trying to shift to other types of technology that they think will have less regulation and oversight. Not only are we working on legislation nationally at the local, state, federal level to make calls free, but we've also done a lot of work at the Federal Communications Commission of the FCC on the regulatory side of things, which is to say, you know, where we want to lower costs nationwide by essentially creating regulation. Well, you know, these companies are now thinking about how to move communication to technologies that are not regulated by the FCC in order to avoid the rate caps set by the agency. So that's sort of, you know, something we're looking out for. But, you know, the companies are constantly trying to reinvent themselves in a way to get out under, you know, what is a lot of pressure at this point to transform an industry. You know, over the last few years, we've seen obviously a big move to video calling. Which, you know, the companies love to call video visitation, but we very, very staunchly opposed to those terms. That was a term created in order to try to synonymize the idea of a video call with a true visit. And the reality is we know that there is no version of a video call that feels like a hug. And, you know, that a video call can never replace in-person visits. But that was their language. I would say, you know, not every slogan is trademarked. And that was one that they really pushed heavily and, in fact, worked for them. Many of the facilities that introduced video calling did, in fact, remove in-person visits so that they could drive more traffic towards these video calling platforms and force people to use them, which are very expensive, and also provided kickbacks back to the agencies. They're also not regulated in the same ways by the FCC and other state regulatory authorities. Now we're seeing a big shift even past video calling, but to tablets. You know, I basically describe it as, you know, correctional facilities are discovering the cell phone the first time, right? It's like the smartphone that we've all had for many, many years. They're now, you know, talking about introducing tablets that have capabilities for phone calls, for video calls, potentially for electronic messaging and for other types of media and entertainment. And again, these tablet devices do not have the same type of regulation. And it's particularly worrisome because some of the agencies that are moving towards the tablet are moving towards the tablet in lieu of wall phones. And so we're going to see how that plays out. So these companies have been engaged in these remarkably predatory practices for decades. And there's more and more of a spotlight on them these days because of these prison phone justice campaigns. And as a result, we see them taking more and more drastic steps to essentially whitewash their predation. And what we're seeing is both the companies and their executives donating to charities, right? Taking on really bizarre contests and partnerships to try to sort of better their image in the public. And There's been a number of recent examples that, you know, have really taken some headlines. For example, Securus, one of the big two, really entered into a partnership with Lecrae, who is a Christian hip hop artist, to do a hip hop contest. You know, it was, you know, just really awful to see somebody who I think, you know, wants to represent well for the community in the music industry partner with such a predatory company to quote unquote try to create hope inside, as if Securus isn't stripping hope from these facilities every single day by exploiting families. You know, we raised that to his team, and unfortunately, you know, he decided to stay in that partnership. You know, we knew he had gotten paid for that. He's since claimed that he will donate that money to charity. But, you know, in the end, we know that there are so many people really disappointed with that partnership. And we know that there's also so many ways for music to create hope in ways that doesn't involve partnering with the industry. And two immediately that come, or three even immediately that come to my mind are, you know, Drakeo, the Ruler was a rapper who actually recorded an entire album last year, or was it in 2019, but an entire album over the phone while he was incarcerated in Los Angeles. And in fact, the name of the album was called Thank You for Using GTL, because of how many times they obviously listened to that, but also they talk about how much money they spent on the calls just to help them record that album. And that was, you know, a really remarkable sort of musical feat, but also act of rebellion, right, against this system that was super necessary. I know, you know, songwriters that have donated musical instruments, right, and other equipment to facilities, so that people who are incarcerated could create music, right? And just recently, a big criminal justice advocate by the name of Jason Flom, who's the CEO of Lava Records and been in the music industry as chairman of Atlantic Records and in many other forums throughout the space, authored a guest column in Variety specifically, you know, taking a pledge to never partner with the prison industry, because we know that the road to hope can never go through that industry. And so we see, you know, we see all of that. On the other side, we saw GTL recently engage in a partnership with Sesame Street. And Sesame Street has historically has a line of its work or a program around supporting children with incarcerated parents. And the donation from GTL was supposed to be used to develop resources to help children with incarcerated parents cope. And there's nothing more, you know, I think ironic, but also detestable to think that the very corporations that are making it hard for children with incarcerated parents, because one in three of those families with an incarcerated loved one goes into debt over the cost of a call because they can't, you know, afford food on their table, the lights in the house, the, you know, car note, are the ones that are going to offer the money to create resources to cope with parental incarceration. It's really something that is hard to stomach, and it's just not palatable. And thankfully, you know, through some advocacy and work, we are hearing that, you know, Sesame Street is rethinking this partnership. And, you know, our hope is that they make the right decision and pull out of it, unlike Lecrae and his team. But it's not, you know, just those kind of stunts. Those are like these PR stunts and that these companies engage in. There's, you know, Securus has its foundation right now that is giving out $25,000 grants to small organizations on the ground, right, doing work in reentry. And it's really, you know, cutting deals with the devil and taking money from, you know, the same, you know, grandmother who is struggling to talk to her son in order to now fund reentry work. And it's a really awful loop that, you know, we really want to stray away from. We want everyone to get involved in the fight for prison phone justice. And we actually have a ton of resources available. Having done this now successfully in multiple different jurisdictions, we have built some toolkits, some messaging guides that can guide activists and organizers, advocates on the ground, no matter what level you want to fight for, whether that's your local county jail or you want to fight for your state. There are resources, and we encourage folks to visit worthrises.org/resources to find some of those. Also visit connectfamiliesnow.com to see what campaigns are already happening across the country that you can plug into. They are always looking for more support, more volunteers, more funding, whatever it might be that you have to give. And finally, I would say, follow the work on the socials. We are on both Twitter and Instagram, just at Worth Rises. And we share a lot about the campaigns, the prison phone justice campaigns around the nation. In particular, calls to action when we need them. So if that's, to sign a petition or send an email or make a call, the best way to stay abreast of those is to sign up for a newsletter on our site or to follow us on social media. But, we hope at this point that everyone takes up the mantle to make calls and communication free, because it is a remarkably necessary tool, to help people come home, to help keep families together, to mitigate trauma for children, to help organize against the system, and to improve reentry outcomes. And so, we really hope people join us.
This has been KiteLine. Thank you to everyone who contributed to the show. You can follow KiteLine Radio on all social media platforms. Please check out our new searchable website with hundreds of archived shows at kitelineradio.org. After a brief hiatus, we're happy to report that our prisoner call-in phone line is back. Folks on the inside or their outside friends and supporters can call 765-343-6236 to record a message to be played on the air. Please share this number widely and we'll try to answer and air all messages possible. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. KiteLine, WFHB, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the opinions expressed on the show. Thank you for listening.
Time.
C. C is for
cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K for
kitten.
Camp.
C. Wait. Sunroof. C. U. Unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in the prison system and beyond.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
Before we get started with this week's theme, we wanted to share some prison-related news and announcements.
On Thursday, Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt commuted the death sentence of Julius Jones to life in prison without the possibility of parole amid protests and a last-minute court appeal that argued the state's execution process amounted to, quote, cruel and unusual punishment. Jones' supporters staged days of protests in advance of his scheduled execution, which was to take place at 5 p.m. Thursday at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in McAllister. Jones has maintained his innocence for more than two decades in the 1999 murder of Paul Howell, a businessman in the affluent Oklahoma City suburb of Edmond. On Wednesday, students at high schools across Oklahoma City walked out of their classes in support of Jones' appeal. Prayer vigils were held at the state capitol, and barricades were erected outside the governor's mansion. Celebrities pleaded his case on Twitter and other social media. Attorneys for Jones filed a motion Thursday seeking an injunction to halt his execution based on, quote, important new evidence from the October 28th execution of inmate John Grant, who vomited and convulsed repeatedly before being declared dead. The motion argued Grant's execution provides, quote, compelling evidence that the execution process in Oklahoma and the use of midazolam, a controversial drug, quote, pose a serious and substantial risk of suffering and pain to prisoners, end quote. In the moments after the announcement, supporters gathered outside the Oklahoma State Penitentiary rejoiced, and clergymen led the group in prayer and song. Protesters outside the governor's office at the state capitol also celebrated the decision. Jones's mother, Madeline Davis Jones, spoke to a group of about 300 people who gathered Wednesday at the Capitol outside Stitt's office, chanting and singing hymns. Quote, "I don't want to go to a lynching," she said. "Why would I want to see someone hang? We should be through with that. Do you want your baby, your child, to be hanged?" End quote.
This week, we continue to talk to our guests about prison phone industry giant Global Tel Link and its attempts to whitewash its image by donating money to Sesame Street. Recent grassroots activism from incarcerated people and advocates have led to a wave of legislation mandating reduced costs or even free phone calls in some cities and states. Unfortunately, Tennessee is not one of those states. Now, we speak with Drew Morgan, comedian, writer, and actor, about the cost of keeping in touch with his brother, who's incarcerated in Tennessee. Here he is.
My name is Drew Morgan. I'm a stand-up comedian and writer. I live in Los Angeles. I'm from Tennessee, which is where my brother is incarcerated and where I grew up. I'm a big fan of Sesame Street and not a big fan of what's currently going on. I think it's sinister. And I mean that in the truest sense of that word. What lobbyists on the industrial prison side of things are doing and some of the PR moves they're doing, it's truly harrowing. I heard about it on Twitter and I looked into it and saw what was going on. And at first I was like, I could see how somebody at Sesame Street would be fooled by this. And then I thought about it for a second. I was like, yeah, for like a day or two. Like, these are some of the savviest people. They have people that work for them and people that they work with whose job it is to suss out stuff like this. And Twitter has pointed it out to them at this point. And then I got really sad because I realized, yeah, but they're getting a bunch of money for it. And that's what this is about.
Yeah.
And I got frustrated with myself, honestly, about getting sad because it was like, I know better than to have any faith in any corporation, especially one that size. But here I am upset. You know, it was like Elmo did this to me. You know, it's like Big Bird's breaking my heart. But, you know, that's not what this is. This is a company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, I feel the same way. It was something that we grew up with and that feels really wholesome and personal. As a artist and a comedian, what kind of interventions like you think can come out of this dystopian nightmare situation? Like, do you find any dark inspiration from that at all?
I find dark inspiration everywhere. It's sort of my brand of humor, for better or for worse, mostly worse financially. But I don't find a lot of solace or hope in the way things are structured currently in this country. Because we put profits over people every step of the way, I genuinely believe that someone or some groups at Sesame Street had the realization that a lot of kids have incarcerated parents and someone needs to help them cope with that. And then the way our society is structured, by the time we come out the other side from, I mean, I genuinely believe this, that idea started as a positive thing, a genuine concern someone at that company has who worked to work at that company because they love kids and they have a childhood development degree and they are concerned about the world. And here was a place, what better place than Sesame Street? And by the time it went up the food chain and back down, at that company and they started seeking out ways to get it done, a very, very powerful player in the prison industrial world offered to foot the bill. And once that offer was made, it's over. It's analogous to, in my opinion, the way a lot of nonprofits are currently working, unfortunately. And it's bleak. It's bleak. I'm not sure if it should be any more bleak than the fact that private prisons are not feeding prisoners, but it feels more bleak that Sesame Street is helping someone essentially run PR. And I guess it goes back to what I was saying. It shouldn't feel any worse than that. The idea that companies can do evil or do bad or help someone do bad should be depressing across the board. But it does feel extra depressing knowing that Sesame Street is ostensibly or was ostensibly founded from a place of loving children and helping children. So I guess that's one of the harder parts of it on a human level is I genuinely believe this started out as a project with good intentions because kids do need help learning how to cope with reality, with the reality of a parent being incarcerated. And Sesame Street is in a unique position to help that along, to, I don't want to say normalize it because I don't think we should make it normal, but maybe get rid of some of the shame and make kids who are in that situation feel like they have other kids like them that they can relate to. And for it to be corporatized like this, it just hurts a part of your soul.
For sure. Do you want to talk a little bit about your brother and what it's like to try to keep in touch with him when he's in prison in Tennessee?
Sure. My brother's incarcerated in Tennessee. At this point, he has been in 6 institutions, 3 of which are private, if I'm doing my math and my memory's working this morning. At all of them, GTL, that recording, that sweet sounding young lady has been who I hear when he calls. So whether it's private or a public institution, GTL is who has the contract. I don't know if that's true for the entire state of Tennessee, but, you know, we're 6 out of, I want to say 9 or 10 for males at this point. So I think I got a pretty good idea that that's how that contract's working. I have to put money on a card in advance. $25, $50, $100 at a time. And then it costs so much to connect me right off the top. Like the first phone call is like $4, no matter how long it is or something like that, which I don't understand why they don't just say anyway. Then after that, there's a connection cost and it's so much per minute. And I don't know what it is. I don't keep up with it. For me, being out here, you know, I talk to a lot of my family on the phone more than I see them. So the main way it affects his and I relationship is I can't call him back. There's no mechanism to do that in any prison that I know of in America. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, no matter how much I pay. GTL collects money feeding off my desire to have a relationship with my brother. It does so by charging me basically to have a connection with him. It's a one-way thing. Like I said, when he doesn't call for a while, I worry like anyone else. And then I call mama to see if she's heard from him. Sometimes she has, and sometimes she has not. My mom, on the other hand, has a lot more on her plate. My brother has 3 children, 2 boys, 16 and 14. My brother went in when they were 9 and 7, maybe 10 and 8, depending on when the trial fell. Well, that's kind of a blur. Then he has an 8-year-old daughter that my mother has shared custody of with my niece's other grandparents. The way GTL works, you can set it up to where it rings on more than one phone. So when my brother calls, it calls on the mother of his 2 boys' phone and my mom's phone. And essentially the deal is whichever one of them is with the kids will answer. Obviously there's times where neither of them are with the kids or one's with one kid and the other's with the other 2. How she balances that emotionally and logistically, I'm not entirely sure. My brother and his ex-wife, as far as this kind of thing goes, have a decent relationship, but obviously it's tough. My mother probably spends close to $200 a month. Between 3 kids, herself, my father, and his ex-wife. My brother's sentence is long. I mean, you just do the math. That's over $2,000 a year. When I tweeted about it, which is why, you know, you and I got together to have this conversation, I think I said over 10,000, but then I redid the math and it's much more than that at this point. I don't know a lot about telecommunications, but I know what my cell phone bill is. I have unlimited data. I travel for work. I download Netflix movies before I get on the plane. I watch them on the plane, hour and a half, HD, right there in the palm of my hand. I tweet out to my dozens of fans. I'm kidding. There's at least 20,000. They tweet back to me in real time, the way you and I connected, the way we're doing this right now. If you add up what that cost me, it's not even close. And we're talking about unlimited data. I am almost afraid to look into GTL's books because I'm like afraid to find out how much money they make. But you can get a sense of it when they are able to foot the bill for this entire Sesame Street project. I know a little bit about show business because I'm in it. I've sold TV shows. I've never gotten to make one. I know what the budgets for those things are. And I think anyone familiar at all with like being a fan of TV shows knows what they call Hollywood math, Hollywood accounting. They're making almost unfathomable amounts of money off of people's desire and need to have a connection with their family. In my particular case, a son, an ex-husband, and a father and a brother. And to think about an 8-year-old girl who's never ever seen her father outside of prison, and my mother knowing that and trying desperately to keep that relationship going since my brother wants to, you know, the fact that he wants to be involved. And what I guess a lot of people who don't go through this don't think about is every family has issues. And when you've got kids who a parent is incarcerated, there's going to be probably extra issues, emergencies, painful things, scares, whether it be someone getting in trouble, someone getting hurt, whatever it is. And GTL is the lifeline. It's the only way to connect other than a letter that takes forever. And for them to not only exploit that for obscene amounts of profit, but to now try to make propaganda, that's what's about to happen with this Sesame Street thing, to pretend like they're some sort of hero company, some sort of woke company. Pardon my language, it's disgusting. As America reckons with its problems on social media and Facebook and, you know, Twitter and all that, you know, these hypocrisies come to light. We see it in like big cases, like Nike pays Colin Kaepernick to be a spokesman, but they have slave labor making their shoes and stuff. Plus Nike could just tell the NFL, put him in there or we'll pull out. And the NFL would probably have no choice. That you can't make it, but they won't do that. This is an example of that. That's, in my opinion, a little bit more sinister because here's a company that's trying to control the narrative before the narrative even really hits the zeitgeist. I am involved in a lot of prison reform type groups, and most people are talking about how the prison industrial complex and its lobbying arm are getting prisons built on states' dimes and not paying taxes and not actually bringing jobs. And those are very important issues. I'm only raising it right now to say this particular one, the phone call thing, it's way down on the list. So the fact that they're jumping out ahead of it, I mean, it just disgusts me at them and at the state of things. I don't have a lot of positive views about it. And I don't really remember what your question was. I think you're asking me about my family. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Thank you. With your nieces and nephews, like you said, like you imagine that there are people in Sesame Street who really do care and who really do see the positive role that they can play in kids' lives in this way. which is becoming more and more of a shared experience for young people in this country. But with your nieces and nephews, like, do they love Sesame Street? And do you think that someday, or it maybe you already have had conversations with them about these complexities?
I have conversations with the oldest one about the complexities of the world. I'm so proud of him. He's so smart and he's so sarcastic and contrarian. And I love engaging with him about all of this stuff. When I say all of this stuff, I mean the complexities of the world. It is frankly difficult to engage with him about things as it relates to his father. It's gotten easy. I shouldn't say, maybe it's difficult for me, honestly, because it's gotten easier lately. And I've enjoyed talking to him about how his father ended up in the position that he's in, which parts of that were institutional and societal, and which parts of that were his father's bad decisions. And that's why this type of thing is so important, whatever it is. I'm not saying Sesame Street should be out here teaching kids about drugs, but they should be out here. You know, someone should be out here teaching kids about the realities of the world. And some of that will include for the children of incarcerated parents how to cope with this stuff. To the first part of your question, are they fans of Sesame Street? The oldest two, not in a long time. The younger one was in the Elmo for a little while, but frankly, now she's way more into TikTok and Cardi B and a lot of other stuff that is very not Sesame Street. And I feel like Sesame Street is such a huge brand. The bigger thing is that this is going to make its way into schools, I fear, and it's going to make its way into programs. It's going to make its way into the lives of overworked social workers, you know, who need resources, who need help with stuff like this. Sesame Street's, to me, biggest attribute is here is a standard way to teach kids that's fun. You know, you can just download it or pay a little price or whatever, and now your kid is engaged in learning about the alphabet. That's important. And again, I guess that's why it's so depressing. I kind of go back to, I mean, we're talking about education and prisons. At the heart of this, what we're talking about is places where profits should not be unequivocally the most important thing.
Yeah.
And I do talk with the oldest one about stuff like that. I do talk, and I try to engage the middle one with that too. He's not quite ready, I don't think. As far as their relationship to Sesame Street, I think for them, you know, it's been a while since they've engaged with that, and they would be ready with something a little bit more well, adult for growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you said, I mean, the profit motive for the decision makers of Sesame Street is what's driving this relationship and this partnership, if you can call it that, with GTL.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough because, like I said, I feel silly saying this, but I guess we're, a lot of us are just like, oh, we trusted you, which is sort of what they're brand is in a way. It's sort of what their whole thing is you trust me with your kids, and I don't anymore. You know, it's like you can boycott stuff out of principle, and I would and I will boycott Sesame Street out of principle when I have my own kids, but like also I don't trust them anymore as a company. It's, and again, I believe there are people who work there, artists as you referenced, and writers, and just great people who work there who want to help kids, but like the company clearly has gone rotten. And I say clearly, not just because they did this, which was bad enough. It's still on schedule as far as I know, in spite of people kind of pointing out like, hey, you're saying you're going to make this special for the children of incarcerated kids, but you're partnering with one of the most, you know, they exploit people's fear, pain, and desire to have a connection with their family. You absolutely cannot help children when you partner with the people who are hurting the children. And that's, frankly, so basic. I probably learned it on Sesame Street. That is such a basic tenet of being a human being that you can't help a group in need by partnering with the people who are f-ing them over. And how Sesame Street itself missed that lesson, I was going to say is beyond me, but it's not. They have people at the top who went to business school, who are trained in the ways of making profit and making the books match, et cetera, et cetera. And they do have PR people, but the PR people are only obsessed with how it looks. And no one's clearly no one there, at least not high enough up, is going, what about just what we stand for as a company? And maybe we're all naive to think companies stand for anything other than making money anymore. Or maybe they never did.
I think that's a good point. Can you talk a little bit about the process of writing letters to your brother? Is that like a alternative to GTL that has worked for your relationship? And or is that
for me personally or my whole family?
Both. Mm-hmm.
For me personally, writing my brother has been frankly difficult. And there are times where I feel, I guess, shame for not writing him more, and other times where I'm like, nope, it's just not where I'm at with it. It's letters are so intimate. They're one-sided, and I'm not much for small talk, period, much less in written form. It's not an alternative because of time. It's not an alternative because it's one-sided, you know. Pen pals were a thing we did when we were younger. I don't know if kids still do that. They probably just tweeted each other, but that's a cool thing, but it's not a relationship with a brother. Now, to be fair, talking on the phone with somebody is not a relationship with a brother. It's not a standard one or a typical one, but no, it's not a substitute. It is a thing you can do. It is a thing that can be helpful. I've written him a few letters where I felt like I had something long to say to him, that maybe I wanted it to be one-sided, but it's not a substitute for me. As for my family, no, writing letters is not a substitute for an 8-year-old. And it's not a substitute for a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old, especially when these are kids who, well, like I just alluded to, they're growing up in a different time. They don't really write letters. That sounds like someone asking me if I sent a telegraph. They genuinely don't have any cultural connection to that. And they can try, but there's problems with that too. You know, someone's going to be reading it. That's difficult. You know, then you got the choice as a parent to tell the 14-year-old that versus not. You get it back. You can tell it's been opened. You can tell that what your father wrote to you was read by a stranger. I guess that exists with the phone call. You know, it's being monitored, but there's not as much evidence of it there, for one. For two, there's no day-to-day. And then, like I was alluding to earlier, with letters, there's no, like, hey, I got my first heartbreak. And I'd like to know if that ever happened to you, Dad, and how'd you deal with it? And you can write that letter. It would take it, I mean, right now, especially with the pandemic, 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks to get one back. That's assuming he's got paper and pen at that time and it hasn't been taken because his whole quad's on lockdown or whatever. It's just really difficult. And it's prison. Prison is difficult. But GTL makes it profoundly more difficult on families financially, emotionally, strictly for the reason of making profit. And it's truly, truly obscene and unnecessary in the day and age that we live in. The notion that this cannot be done without them or at less of a profit, that's offensive to my common sense. I know better. I know what my cell phone bill is, and I'm streaming freaking live sports. You're charging me what I pay a month to Netflix to get borderline unlimited entertainment in high definition for a 5-minute phone call. It's a phone. It's a landline.
Right. It's definitely not about the service that they're providing at all. It's about their ability to just do it. Yeah.
And Sesame Street is running cover for them now. That is what the result of this is in the big picture. That is why GTL wanted to do this in the first place. Sesame Street's brand as wholesome, good for kids, good for families is so strong that GTL is using it as cover. And taking the heart out of it, I cannot believe that Sesame Street's business people didn't see that and recognize it as a potential problem. Mm-hmm. I can only think of two things. One, they just didn't look into it deeply enough. Or two, they recognize that people who are incarcerated are low enough down on our culture's totem pole, and that includes their families, that who gives a shit? You know, the Sesame Street brand will be fine just because a bunch of criminals and their families are mad at us. And I hope it's not that. I think a lot of people don't care about prisoners or their families. It just doesn't bother them what's happening to an 8-year-old when her grandma is doing end of the month math to decide whether or not she can speak with her father right now. What that does to the kid, what that does to the grandmother, or what that does to the incarcerated individual, I just don't think people care enough, and that makes me sad. But then you got folks who do care, folks like you, and thank you for doing this podcast and being involved in this work. We are up against a different problem, which is that business is seen almost as our religion. Sesame Street saw this as an opportunity to partner with someone in the industry who's also going to help us foot the bill, because all of the things we are talking about, exploiting people's pain for profit, that's normal. That's standard operating procedure. So I almost get how someone who went to business school was like, what? Yeah, they're charging for service. And there's no more thought. Well, they're charging the amount people are willing to pay. And there's no more thought. And again, ironically, not seeing how that creates a horrible society and how you're being selfish and how it's creating a place that's not good.
Plus d'un an qu'on le mentionne, et que de toute façon, vous le savez probablement déjà, on a décidé de ne pas vous le dire. Donc, on ne vous redira pas que pour se protéger de la COVID-19, il faut se laver les... On ne répétera pas encore une fois qu'il faut porter un... Et surtout, qu'il faut garder nos... avec les autres. Vous le savez, c'est la meilleure façon de combattre le virus, même lorsqu'on est vacciné. On continue de se protéger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.